Welcome to our discussion segment on Admiral Zheng He. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
And today we're talking about Those Savage Waves, Zheng He and the Ming Treasure Fleet. Let's get started.
Hey, John.
How's it going?
Good.
Good.
So I really enjoyed this podcast. I have to admit, I'm a little taken aback because I read it and I was just thinking, this is pretty, I don't want to say speculative, but it is a topic of controversy.
It is. It very much is, yeah.
And because... growing up in school, you read about Columbus, you read about...
1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue,
all right, that. Yeah. You read about the possible Viking ships that came to either Canadian shores or our shores. But you never hear about any Chinese fleets.
Well, this was... the map, again, was discovered in 2006, and so... you were in high school in the early dark ages, I believe. So they didn't know about that when you were, and nor did they know.
Yeah, I mean, but you would think something would have come through, some bit of writing, something like that.
Oh, I agree. And again, as I said in the podcast, I don't know. I don't really take a position on whether or not this actually happened. I just kind of thought it was an interesting, kind of a different way to start a season on American history with a kind of a what if scenario. So I figured we would go with this.
Well, that leads into my first question.
Okay.
What prompted you to select this story?
A couple things. I have always enjoyed speculative history or alternative what-if history. I know that kind of makes me a bit of an outcast with other professional historians. They tend to kind of look down on speculative history as really it's little more than fiction, and history is all about facts. But I think there's incredible value in understanding what could have happened, because that shows us, one, where we could go, and two, it shows us the importance of human action. That history is made by the people who show up. It's not made by fate or reason or anything else. History is made by human beings. It's directed, depending on your religious beliefs, in various ways, but ultimately it is human action that makes history what it is. So that's the first reason. The second reason, quite frankly, was commercial. I wanted our second episode, the first one after the survey, to be kind of unique and to really stand out. And I thought this was a good way to do it.
I agree with that 100%. Yep. When I was listening to this episode and reading about Zheng He, I was just surprised at the hostility that Menzies encountered when he proposed this idea.
Yes.
To your point earlier, I shouldn't have been that surprised, because historians get into I don't want to call it a habit of saying this is exactly how things work.
Oh, they absolutely, it is a habit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and challenging convention in history is very similar to challenging doctrine in religion. I mean, historians, we like to think that we're all about facts, and of course we are, but we have these ingrained biases, like we're going to talk about in other podcasts later this season. Bias is one of kind of the main themes, really, of this season. Historians are biased, and they don't want to consider the possibility that something they have been told and they have believed their entire life, because ultimately we can't know because we don't have time machines, that they're wrong. I think of another example. There's a great deal of controversy surrounding the location of Mount Sinai. Historically, Mount Sinai, which is, you know, for those who are unfamiliar, is a mountain referenced in the Bible. There's a great deal of history that happened at Mount Sinai, and tradition places it in one place. Some people say it actually happened somewhere else, and if it turns out that Mount Sinai is not where we thought it was, you collapse several thousand years of religious tradition, you collapse several thousand years of history, and you collapse several thousand years of tourism, which hurts the Egyptian economy. So people have reasons to really want to dig into to historical fact and hold on to those, even when it's possible that what they have believed for so long is not actually true.
Okay. Do you believe that historians, apart from financial gains that some of them may have?
I don't know that that's financial. I don't know that historians are concerned more about financial gains. I think it's more of a shock to their system, like, oh my gosh, I've been wrong for so long.
Yeah.
Imagine if you or I were told that one of the historical figures that we revere, I mean, take George Washington, who's going to be the subject of a later podcast, or William T. Sherman. If it turns out that George Washington was not the hero that we all thought he was, that in fact he was a war criminal, we would probably push back against that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there are figures in particularly military history who are being reinterpreted right now, and there's a lot of kind of traditional historians who are pushing back against that, whether you're talking about Patton or you're talking about Sherman. People are kind of saying, well, maybe they weren't the kind of whitewashed heroes that they're portrayed to be.
Yeah. It's interesting that when you compare facts of history Because I think in this podcast, you cited a lot of facts. Like there wasn't.
I tried to, yeah.
So it's not just
somebody... Probably more facts in this than in Gavin Menzies' entire book.
So it's not like this concept was just pulled out of thin air. This is based on findings that someone found.
Yes.
Like, and so using this information, they developed a theory that this event actually occurred. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's the important thing. Like when we think about those historical figures that we see in a specific light, it's based on the information that we have at the time.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
And so when new information is presented, we weigh that against the information that we know to be true. As there's nothing, I don't say absolutely know to be true.
Yes.
But as much as we can know.
That's right.
And then we balance as like, yeah, that doesn't seem to match up with what's being said or history that's taken out of context. Mm-hmm. Which is something that I think we both have seen in books and TV shows and films and all that. So
you're never actually going to necessarily discover the ultimate truth because, again, we don't have time machines. But you try and close in on the closest thing you can get to the truth.
Yeah. I can't read my own writing. I want to talk to you about the size of these ships.
Yes.
That you saw.
They're massive.
So when I was in high school, I went on a trip with Outward Bound.
Mm-hmm.
Great organization, by the way. Challenging. I chose sailing. You can choose whatever. There's dog sledding, sailing, there's hiking, all these things. So I chose to go sailing. It was a 32-foot long sailboat with full sails and everything else. And on the days when we had no wind, we had to row with massive oars.
Did you really? Oh, wow.
It was fantastic. It was 2 weeks in the Chesapeake Bay, and then we would go out actually at sea for a while and then come back.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah, it was great. But anyway, when I think about that 32-foot long, 36-foot long, somewhere in that range, boat, and then I think about a 600-foot long boat,
mm-hmm.
you can understand historically when somebody reads this, like, yeah, right.
Oh,
like,
absolutely.
So how would you as a historian, based on the information that you've read about this event, speak to that? If somebody challenged you, John Streeter, like, hey, there's no way that a boat was that
short. Right. Well, I would point them back to, as I mentioned in the podcast, the discovery of that enormous rudder in the that was kind of buried in the mud of the Yangtze River near the dockyards at, I believe it's at Nanking. This rudder was massive, and you wouldn't have a rudder that size on a ship that was maybe 100 feet long or a little bit less, like the size of the Santa Maria. The thing would be almost as large as the ship itself. A rudder that size would guide a ship that is 500-600 feet long, and it's right there. So unless that's part of basically an elaborate hoax, I firmly believe that the Ming treasure fleets existed, that the ships that are being described there were real. I don't know that they came to the United States or to the New World. That's a separate question. But yeah, I mean, those ships are absolutely massive. It's about 100 feet shorter than a World War II aircraft carrier.
That's amazing.
That's how big these things were.
That's amazing.
We think of 9-mast. I mean, our image of a ship, of a European sailing ship, is those 3-mast galleons.
That's massive ships. Unbelievable. In a positive way. It's just, it's amazing. So on top of that topic, back in season one, we talked intermittently about the idea of a bias.
Yes.
Like when you talk about history, usually the historian has to fight his or her own bias in order to report what actually happened.
Absolutely.
So reading about Gavin Menzies' account of what happened, do you believe that he brought a bias to this reporting? Because it seemed like in the podcast, you said that he doubled down on Chinese exploration after he received a lot of pushback. And it seemed like his claim was pretty, I don't want to say outrageous.
Well, the second claim was ridiculous.
Okay.
And almost everyone believes the Chinese did not start the Renaissance.
Yeah. I was trying to think of a nice way to say that, but that's the way to say it.
We call facts here on 15 Minute History.
So ridiculous is the word. So with that in mind, if that's what he did as an answer to the criticism, do we then question what motivated him to push forward on this?
I don't know the full body of his work, so I can't speak to that. I've read 1421. Was there bias, or was he simply trying to make the point of his book? I really can't tell. Gavin Menzies, from what I do know of him, basically reading up for this podcast, he's not an anti-Western historian, but he is a revisionist Western historian. He likes to ascribe technological and social developments to the East, specifically to China, that historically have been attributed first and foremost to the West. That's why in his second book, he says that the Chinese started the Renaissance. So if there is a bias, it would be that. It would be his desire to push a narrative that said, well, China did it first before the Westerners came to North America, which is factually inaccurate because Vikings were here 600 years before the Chinese. But that's a separate issue there.
Yeah.
So, but he could be in his own mind just looking for facts. I don't want to ascribe motive to what he's saying, because if he has a podcast, I want him to review us favorably. So we gotta try and be nice here.
Yeah.
Even as I mocked his second book as garbage.
Yeah, and the purpose for just doing a follow-up on that again is just to verify, as I said, when you read about a second book, like, you tend to question, okay, the first book, same thing.
So. Yeah, very true. I plan on getting a copy of a second book and reading it, because I do want to be more educated on this topic, because I will say I'm much more, as I said in season one, much more of a Western historian. I'm getting more into learning much more of Eastern culture, and it's absolutely fascinating. So I do plan on reading that book at some point.
Great.
Yeah.
So in terms of colonization, you talked briefly about that in the podcast. Why? Let's go with the theory that the Chinese did arrive on our shores.
Okay.
What would have compelled them to either settle or set up something there, some type of settlement? Or what would have compelled them to do that? And what would have compelled them not to do that?
I doubt they would have set up a settlement. Again, using the historical facts that we do know, as they sailed the coasts of Indochina and India and the Middle East and Africa, they engaged in trade and cultural contact, but they did not plant settlements. Again, as far as we know, archaeologists haven't found any examples of Chinese architecture or anything like that in any of those places. So we know there was cultural exchange, that they met with those people, they traded with those people. We found plenty of Chinese artifacts as far south as, I think, Mozambique and Madagascar. So it's more likely that there would have been cultural contact and cultural interchange with the Native American tribes of the West Coast than there would be any kind of Chinese settlement, say, in San Francisco or something like that, at least in the period of the Yongle and the Hongxi emperors. Now, maybe going forward, as China was trying to become a bit more aggressive, you could maybe make the case that once European contact with the New World had happened, the Chinese would have realized, oh man, we've got to get in there before the Europeans do and grab as much of that territory as we can, as the Spanish and the French and later the English are coming in. Then you could have seen some kind of settlement, maybe in Baja California or in California proper. What that would have looked like, I really don't know. But they wouldn't have immediately started conquering like the Spanish did. I mean, within a generation of Columbus, they've conquered all of what is now called Latin America.
Okay. So how would that have turned the tide then? And if their intention, based on historical evidence, was not to settle or set up a settlement, how would that have affected European settlements? How would that have changed history? Like, again, assuming that they came here, and they traded and they set foot on our shores, would that have changed the course of history? I mean, obviously, like, if it's true, it didn't, but I mean, assuming.
I think the most interesting kind of what if part of that is in the area of military technology. This is not because I'm a military historian, but if you look at presumed cultural contact between the Chinese and the Native Americans, if they're trading pottery or basic cultural items, there's not going to be much of a difference when the Europeans land with their guns and their horses and their diseases and all of that. But remember, the Chinese had gunpowder in the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. They used it mainly for fireworks. That was not a stereotype or any kind of racial remark in the podcast. That's what they used historically gunpowder for, was for their fireworks. Is it possible that the Chinese, not really having a whole lot of contact with the Europeans, basically going to the west of China, going through the Middle East and into Europe, but they would have gotten some kind of cultural contact with the Europeans in the New World, would they have realized, oh my gosh, as they're watching Hernando Cortez massacre the Aztecs with a couple hundred men with muskets, we have the same technology and we need to start developing it as a military weapon.
Interesting.
Would they have then shared that with the Indians? It's certainly possible. So it really hinges on the issue of, one, would they have shared their military technology? And two, and I confess a lack of knowledge on this, are the materials available in Latin America to create gunpowder? I assume that they are. I mean, sulfur and saltpeter are relatively easy to find. So if the Chinese had shared that technology and if the Indians were able to make these weapons, then maybe there would have been a greater resistance. It would have been a more mature Indian society in the sense they would have been more developed, more advanced. The Aztecs would have, and the Incas, and then the tribes here in the United States could have had more advanced weaponry. Still would have been vulnerable to diseases, but they would have been able to militarily resist a lot better.
Okay. At the end of this episode, you talk about how this is more of an intellectual exercise.
Yes.
So tell me, in your opinion, how should people read counterfactual history? Because there are books talking about what if this, what if that. give our audience an idea of how they should read it, how it's helpful, and why it's important.
Generally speaking, it's entertainment. I mean, for most people, it's sheer entertainment. But like in all fiction, there are lessons to be drawn from it. I don't want to hold counterfactual history up as being more relevant than any other type of fiction because, quite frankly, it's all fiction. I think the best kind of way to explain this is to go back to something else that we talked about in season one when we were talking about the rigors of war and we were specifically talking about Total War. We brought up one of our favorite books, World War Z. No relevance in terms of like understanding how a zombie war works, but it teaches lessons about human psychology and specifically about warfare.
Mm.
If you go to classic works of literature, they all teach broad transcendent themes and good moral lessons. Counterfactual history might not do any of that, but they do, again, kind of going back to where I started with this episode and in this discussion, they teach us the importance of our ability to influence history and how we have the ability really to impact not just our community, but the wider world. This is your, you know, very broad historical lesson here that all of us can change history. But it's true. I mean, it sounds cliche. It sounds like something you say at a graduation speech, but it's accurate. Every one of us has the ability to change history. And I think counterfactual history or alternative history is a good way of illustrating that. How you change just one little event and everything changes.
That's very, very interesting.
And it doesn't even have to be a major change. I mean, this is one example. There's another example that I read about in a book that's called What If by Robert Cowley, which I would highly recommend to anyone who's interested in this. He talks about the potato and how the potato has shaped more of human history probably than any human being other than the great men of history. And I won't go into the details, but you can change just one little thing in history and the entire fabric of human civilization can change.
I think, too, it also shows us how important these events were. That if they if they hadn't happened the way that they did, here's what could have happened as a result.
Absolutely.
Because I think we've run into this all the time, that history usually is seen as, like, knowing dates and, like, when specifically who did what.
I do, too.
But understanding the importance behind these events and how they influenced how we live today is so important.
Very much.
It's interesting that you brought up World War Z again, because I remember reading about a talk that the author gave at a college where he was asking, okay, all of you, what would you do if something like this happened? He just said, shout it out. He said, I would grab knives, I would get guns. Yeah. He said, okay, all right, great. So let's talk practicalities here. How many of you know how to work on your car? No one raised their hand. He's like, okay. So he just goes through each of these basic things that we need, again, spawning from this story where you're dealing with here's the what if.
Yeah.
And it's just it's so interesting to have that kind of thrown in your face and realize, oh,
yep,
you're absolutely right. Anyways, so here's my last question. When is studying counterfactual history helpful and when is it harmful?
It's helpful kind of for the reasons we talked about in that last question before our World War Z detour. I don't know that counterfactual history is ever harmful, as long as you understand that it's not real history. I mean, it's kind of like playing a video game. I mean, you're rewriting history every time you play Call of Duty, and if you're playing on the German side and the Germans win. I don't know that, because it has no impact on today, so I don't know that counterfactual history is ever inherently harmful.
I was asking in regards to what we would call revisionist history, because there are some groups, I'm not saying anyone here specifically, but there are some groups that would call revisionist history counterfactual, because it is something that would be somebody looks at a specific time period in context or out of context at a specific event that's happening and brings up an interpretation that totally departs from what...
Well, revisionist history is very different from counterfactual, because good revisionist historians, and there are some, we tend to think of revisionist history as, oh my gosh, that's so bad. It's not inherently evil or bad or wrong or anything like that, as long as it is grounded in fact. Counterfactual history ignores what actually happened, the facts of history, and comes up with the what-if scenario.
Right.
So I would classify counterfactual history and revisionist history as two very different things. People who don't understand the art and the craft of historiography might label revisionist history as counterfactual simply because they don't like the reinterpretation. But if you look at the facts and you recognize, wow, we're interpreting based on the original facts we have, now we have new facts that we have been verified through whatever tools that the historian uses, turns out these are true. We have to reinterpret. If you cling to an interpretation of history that is contradicted by the facts, it's not history anymore. It's religion. And history is not a religious discipline. It's not a religious science, basically, or a religious system.
So how would you classify this episode then? Because you did lay out facts.
Yeah.
And you did go over pieces of history that was found that was that would substantiate this claim.
Up until I went into the what if of going forward, what would North America look like if the Chinese had actually done that? That was historiography. Okay. That was the science of studying and interpreting history. Okay. And that is a perfectly legitimate academic discipline. Okay. And there are historians whose whole job is historiography. That's all they do. They don't look for new history. They don't write new history. They reinterpret and reevaluate existing history.
Yeah.
That last bit where I was kind of like, let's just play the what if game. That's kind of counterfactual. And that's, I put that in there because I think it's, again, it's interesting to look at. But it should not be considered as part of the history that we are covering in this chapter.
Right. And the reason for me asking all of this is because I definitely wanted to clarify what we would consider revisionist versus counterfactual. Because to your point, there are a lot of people who would say that it's one and the same.
Yes.
Or they would get the terms confused accidentally. Mm-hmm. So it just was, an exercise in trying to make that a bit clearer.
Sure.
So,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Those Savage Waves, Zheng He and the Ming Treasure Fleet. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review on iTunes. It really does help. Thank you, and see you next week.